Okay, so we are back again for another episode of the FLT podcast. As many of you with sharp eyes may have noticed, Finland has recently gone through presidential election and we have elected a new leader here, Alexander Stubb. Maybe just a bit of background. So in Finland, the president is elected every 6 years. The president must be a naturally born Finn. There is a proportional representation system in Finland, which means while there is party affiliation, in general, people don't vote for the party. They vote for the candidate that speaks to them most. With that election cycle just completed, we thought it would be a very good idea to bring in an expert with a broad political view. And so we have invited the fabulous Teivo Teivainen. How are you doing, Teivo?
After your flattering comments, I'm feeling great.
Good. Are you happy with the presidential election results?
I don't think in those terms. I just analyze stuff. To be honest, when I talk about people, those political scientists, they must have their, you know, this and that and something. And I try to analyze things. I don't care what I think. Of course, I vote. And I have my preferences, but I don't know. It happened, and yeah, nothing overly horrible happened.
Okay, as happy as you've ever been with the political system. Good, good, good. As always, we've prepared a little bit of an introduction for you. Annalie, would you do the honors?
Yes, absolutely. So, Teivo, you are a professor of world politics at the University of Helsinki, where you also received your PhD. You are the founding director of the program on democracy and global transformation at the San Marcos University in Peru. And you have been recently nominated as the chairman of the Finnish National Commission of UNESCO. Your research focuses on global political economy, human rights, transnational social movements, global democracy, and the contradictions of capitalism. You have held several professor positions, lectured, led, and participated as an expert in numerous international projects in Canada, in the USA, Central and South America, and South Africa, amongst many. You have also received awards for your work, and you are a distinguished member of several editorial boards of scientific journals. So, you are a significant leader yourself and a thought leader. This is a very short description of you. Is it a fair description? And if I may ask about the elections, what questions do you most get from related to the Finnish elections?
About the Finnish elections, the last two ones that happened, the parliamentary elections, the key question, because I got many, many calls from international media, so there was only one answer. It's Sanna Marin. Our editor said, go and do a story on the Finnish election because there's this Sanna Marin person. So now there was no Sanna Marin. There was a little bit less international interest, perhaps. Also, people wanted to get the general outline of what's happening in Finland. Of course, the foreign policy, Russia issue was NATO. That was probably the key thing. Will anything change?
And was the interest around Sanna Marin about her career, about being a young woman, about all of this?
Well, she was just somebody who got so much media attention from around the world. So I guess editors in many kinds of media around the world thought it would be interesting to follow whether she'll get reelected, and even, you know, people didn't necessarily understand exactly what prime minister, president, all that. She was leader of Finland. And now there's an election and somebody had heard that maybe she's not going to get reelected. And then they were like, how come? She's so great. And then they wanted me to explain that.
Excellent. Thank you.
Yeah. And how about the description of you? Is it a fair summary?
I guess so. I mean, you focus on leadership issues here. So there it's, I remember when I was director of a department, political science department, where leadership studies were were concentrated at the University of Helsinki, and I used to be a little bit critical of some of the tendencies in leadership studies at the moment, and it was created sometimes funny situations being leader of the department where leadership studies were concentrated and being a little bit critical of tendencies within the leadership studies. It was a moment when leadership became a thing in University of Helsinki, and it was sometimes it sounded like a bullshit generator, like the university saying, no, we need to focus on leadership and leadership of this and that, and everything became just, you know, leadership, everything. And of course, leadership is important, but there was this moment when leadership was added to just about anything, and it was a little bit funny to
be leading the department in charge of leading the leadership vacation of everything.
It sounds like an academic storm in a water glass, as we say in Finnish.
Myrskyvesilasissa. Do you see yourself as a leader, actually?
I'm not sure. I try to avoid that kind of
What kind of term would you use to describe yourself, if not a leader?
I don't know. Somebody who asks questions. I've liked, actually, there's this Mexican social movement thing, like asking questions, we walk. So I like that kind of approach. You walk and you ask questions while you walk. And I sometimes get this, like people tend to think I have a lot of opinions. And then I ask, well, what opinion are you referring to? Because I don't really have an opinion on this or that, what I'm commenting. I don't know, independence of Catalonia or even NATO and Finland in NATO or something. These are things I didn't have an opinion. I honestly didn't have one. I didn't present one, but people always assume, you must have this or that position because of that. It's an interesting thing. So I like to ask questions more than
academics tend to be good at asking questions, but not so good at giving answers, right?
But I think academics can be useful in providing different scenarios for different answers and providing justifications. If you answer that way, then, you know, the coherence of answers and stuff like that. So I don't think academics that ask questions are irrelevant for responding to the questions. But it's a normative task more of politicians in some sense to choose between the different answers.
So we enable others to give answers.
Yeah, sort of.
Okay. So not a leader, but an inquisitive walker.
Yeah, something like that.
All right, Teivo. So even though you said that you're not interested in what you think, we and our listeners actually are very much interested in what you have to say, what you think. So how would you, now with these elections behind us, how would you kind of describe them? Anything that stood out in some way compared to previous elections?
Well, in Finland, elections tend to be pretty lame and boring in general compared to many other elections. So, you know, there isn't that much spark there. There was a little bit more in parliamentary elections. That tends to happen. But in presidential elections, because president focuses so much on foreign policy, and in Finland there's a tradition of having something close to national consensus on foreign policy, so there's, because of that, also less room for strong disagreements. And now, because of the big changes in Finnish foreign policy, in the public opinion and in the opinion of leaders, with a new, not total consensus, but pretty strong majority opinion in favor of NATO membership and all that. So that also meant that there were very few differences of substance. And the differences of style also, they were quite cordial. I think one reason being when Alexander Stubb started his campaign, he started with a charm offensive in some sense, saying, coming when he became the candidate, and he was like telling everyone, but these other candidates, they are really, really great. I really appreciate you. That was his style, and it set a little bit the tone for the whole thing. After that, you know, it was more difficult for others to challenge in an aggressive style others, and it almost didn't happen in the second round a little bit, but between Haavisto and Stubb, but even there, not so much.
But, I mean, there wasn't, like you said, there wasn't really a lot of space or room to maneuver in the policy space. And we started with a charm offensive. Is that why there were so many candidates? Because this time around, there's very little to choose from in terms of what actually the president will do when they get there. But we had nine choices or nine options to choose from.
Yeah, but there are always quite a few candidates, and most of them knew from the beginning that they stand no chance of getting to the second round or winning the election. It's a moment to, you know, be present. And for the political parties, you know, now we can speculate that those who didn't make it to the second round, for example, the Swedish People Party, Swedish People's Party, did not present a candidate. And after all, maybe it was a good decision. They, you know. Then you think of the Social Democrats that presented a candidate, and the candidate did not do very well in terms of numbers, at least in terms of number of votes. So you could speculate: would it have been better, for example, for the Social Democrats not to present
put a forward candidate? Yeah.
But normally, the general wisdom is you have to put a candidate there if you are a political party, so that you remain relevant in the debates, even if you are not there to win the election.
The Finnish-Swedish party did not have a candidate, but we have got a Finnish-Swedish president, the second actually in the history of Finland.
Yes, and of course, in counterfactual speculation, it could be interesting to think, like, had the Swedish People's Party presented a candidate, which probably would have been somebody named Anders, then he could have taken votes, and it's an interesting speculation. Would he have? He could have been a strong candidate, actually. Many thought so. He could have taken votes from Stubb and also from Haavisto and from whom more, and it could have created a different dynamic from the beginning. But this is counterfactual history.
I think it is interesting, though, that so many of the smaller parties play a role specifically, I guess, in the hope of becoming kingmaker or having that influence in the end on the overall result. If I think about comparisons with the UK or the US, you mentioned it's usually a boring election cycle. I very much appreciate boring election cycles, having witnessed the US and the UK elections or at close quarters. It's nice to actually have one. But in that smaller party field, did anybody stand out as like having a good campaign?
I think of the smaller candidates, my feeling is that on the one hand, Jussi Halla-aho did quite well in terms of his parties, the Finns party, the most right-wing party in that competition. He was seen as somebody who would not make too many compromises with sort of popular opinion. He took some very contrarian positions on, for example, the issue of whether Finland should seek temporary membership in Security Council of the United Nations. And this is almost like a dogma in Finnish foreign policy. Everybody wants that, right? And he said, no, we shouldn't go there. And so he could say things like that. So he sounded a bit more honest. And on the other hand, Li Andersson, who I think got from, because I think generally, even by her opponents, she's seen as somebody who's pretty good in debates.
She is.
Clever and outstanding, even if the party doesn't
grow.
Doesn't fly, even if she got fairly good marks. So I think those two people were seen positively, and perhaps of the mid-sized candidates in terms of votes, Olli Rehn, I think, was somebody who got towards the takeoff phase, so to speak, towards the end of the campaign. And people were thinking, like, hey, he's not so boring and, you know, he's funny and he's cool. So I was thinking in the very last debates when it was clear he's not going to make it to the second round, but he was sort of entertaining some hopes. I was feeling he's already playing the next presidential election. I think he left a fairly decent impression there. And many people were sort of, he was among preferred candidates for many people. Like if you asked, like, who are you, two or three preferred candidates? In those, he was one of the best candidates. So he might have a future there. I have no idea if he's planning to run or something.
A question, actually. So you said that most of these candidates from the beginning kind of knew pretty well that they're not going to win, right? But still, we didn't really see a lot of this like confrontation happening, a lot of this spicing up things. So why do you think that's the case? Why not to actually use this? If you know that you're not going to win anyway, so why not to spice up things a bit?
Well, it could be also in times of war, there's certain sense of duty not to rock the boat, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that plays some role. And the candidates were, I mean, even you could think of Halla and Lee Anderson from perhaps the most leftist, the most rightist part of that spectrum, which is not very wide spectrum. They were, you know, they were able to distinguish themselves and they were able to question some of the sort of established foreign policy consensus, not very radically, but a little bit. But, you know, that's they were still within the consensus. So there were no like really hardcore, let's say, left-wing candidates who would have question NATO membership in any radical ways. Lee Anderson was in favor of NATO membership. And also from the right, the same thing. And this reflects something in Finnish politics, because if you look at Finn's party, the right and left alliance on the left, you look at their equivalents in other European countries, you would have especially groups that would be seen as favoring or understanding Russia much more, and that would create a big divergence. Whereas in Finland, the moderately far right and moderately far left parties are pretty much closer to the consensus than in some other more South European countries. So this also reflects Finnish foreign policy consensus vis-a-vis Russia.
Yeah. There's not really that space to raise up the volume to get emotional and to get heated.
Yeah, and parties that might have done that, whether they are established parties or groups that wanted to get a presidential candidate, they didn't get to actually do the face. They didn't get enough signatures to have to be able to present a candidate. There could have been smaller parties that could have been much more vocal and aggressive and all that.
You mentioned the war at the threshold of Europe. Is that why this election and the debates were so serious? Because, I mean, in my opinion, they were lacking optimism, and optimism creates resilience in people if you instill that. And I was just wondering, is it the war that creates this seriousness, or is it just, or did I interpret seriousness, which actually was boring? Boring debates.
More boring.
I think you're right there. The war did create some of that. It was the first time for several, or at least a couple of generations, where election of a president means that we might be electing somebody who needs to lead us in a real war. So the threat of war and all these things that in Finland are sometimes called like existential threats, which is a way to talk about Russia, right? Are more present than, you know, ever before since the 1940s. Maybe there could have been in the early 60s a couple of moments, Berlin, Cuban crisis and all that. But in general, so this created, again, sense of duty or responsibility or something that, hey, this is serious stuff. We're not simply electing some decorative person there, but this is somebody who might have more real decision-making power and leadership than any of the previous presidents, even though since constitutional reform of 2000, the president has less powers than before with the parliamentarization of the decision-making system. But now NATO and the possibility of war means that president again becomes, at least potentially, a very, very key and central leader. And the and for example, the question who would be the supreme commander of Finnish armed forces in times of war, you don't normally ask these questions, you know, in previous elections, but now it was a real question. So, yes.
Yeah. Would you agree on this observation of lacking optimism? And is optimism an important topic when we talk about elections and electing a leader for a country?
Sure. Look at the United States right now, the lack of optimism about Biden's economic policy, even though the numbers the numbers are in some sense quite good. So normally one would get reelected easily in the United States with those numbers that Biden has with employment and inflation right now and Dow Jones and whatever. So, but there's no optimism. Or there's too little optimism. So it does play a role. In Finland, on the one hand, we have war and the security situation has these existential threats. Then again, I guess for some people, the fifth article of NATO kind of protection means that people might feel more secure. In some sense, the risks are higher. I think most people and decision makers would say, like, risk of a small war with Russia is smaller because the threshold is higher because of NATO and Fifth Article. But then again, if there is a war, it might be more devastating, and Finland is a frontline state, and so risk of annihilation exists more than before. So it's is it optimism or pessimism? It kind of depends.
Well, I mean, so there's definitely that sort of existential threat and context. But one of the things that I thought was interesting throughout that the election process is actually the nature of the election tactics on the message, right? So both Alexander Stubb and Pekka Haavisto were kind of the front runners from day one. And so from both of their positions, they didn't have to put out a particularly spectacular vision of the future, right? They, if you wanted to maintain, get into the runoff, if you're in both of those camps, then your basic tactic is, let's just straight bat all of the answers. Let's just keep people convinced that I'm a statesman and I'm a good politician and I'm responsible. And we don't have to paint a glorious picture of the future, because if we just do a defensive election campaign, we will get into the runoff. And then we can kind of try to make the difference. Do you think that might have played a role in part of the messaging? Or is it from the campaign side, was there the space really to be optimistic?
I think it did, and if we think of Alexander Stubb's successful tactic, there was to not to be aggressively questioning other people, and this charm offensive style beginning for the whole thing. Like, yes, for those two, that was clear. And then in the second round, it changed a little bit. If you continue like that, then it seems Stubb is going to win. So Pekka Haavisto was in the position that he needs to do something. He needs to shake, rock, whatever, the boats. And he tried a bit, but he wasn't successful enough.
In the end, in that runoff, was there a big distinction in the choice that voters had? So between Pekka Haavisto and Alexander Stubb, what was the choice Finns made?
Well, I think something that we sometimes forget, because this leadership thing is so individualized, especially in presidential election, that you don't just elect the individual, but there's a gang behind the individual, and they have like party political affiliations. And here, arguably, you could say that even if Pekka Haavisto and Alexander Stubb were, in terms of style and substance, fairly close to each other, they were much closer to each other than the people who are likely to enter their
cabinet.
The cabinet and whoever else. It's not only the obvious cabinet members that we've now seen the names of people, but in general, you know, presidents still make appointments and stuff like that. So arguably, Pekka Haavisto's party would be more to the left than Pekka Haavisto himself, and Alexander Stubb's party would be more to the right than Alexander Stubb himself. Mm. So that there was a bigger difference there that sometimes people take into account and sometimes not. There was something similar in 1994 when Martti Ahtisaari was running against Elisabeth Rehn. Mm. And in some sense, it seemed like Ahtisaari might have been seen even the more hawkish. And he was pronator, maybe not as explicitly as later and all that. And Elisabeth Rehn, perhaps a more less hawkish and, you know, peace initiative woman and all that. And then you look at the background still behind Ahtisaari, there was the, you know, social democratic workers movement. Exactly. And the other one had more right-wing political parties. So sometimes the differences between the candidates and between the people they represent in some more narrow party political sense are right. different. Mm. And the problem in electoral debates is we, especially in presidential election, we focus perhaps too much on the individuals.
Mm. That's very interesting. So in the end, in the second round, 71% of Finns voted. Almost 30% didn't. Who are these 30% in your opinion?
My fellow political scientists are probably busy making all kinds of analysis of that. But it seems clear that many were people who, of the ones who had voted in the first round and didn't vote in the second round, had voted for either Finns party candidate Jussi Halla-aho, center party candidate Olli Rehn, and they, some of them, stayed at home. Not as many as Pekka Haavisto would have wanted, but but you know, enough of them went to vote so that Stubb would win. Had they all stayed home, Pekka Haavisto could have won. So, but that's, I think, is clear. There are these both anecdotal journalistic evidence, and then let's see when the number crunchers present their studies that in many rural areas, there are towns where many people were saying, okay, of the second round candidates, I'm not going to vote for anyone, you know, I don't like them. Right. Too urban, too liberal, too whatever.
Yeah, there was also one thing that I've read somewhere that I think around 30% of people who voted, actually they said that they voted not in favor of Stubb, but actually kind of against Haavisto. And the reason for that was the sexual orientation of Haavisto. Do you believe that that might have been an important factor?
Well, there's some research, again, done in my unit, also in the University of Helsinki in political science, that indicates that, yes, that was the case. And it was the percentage of people saying it did have an impact, Haavisto's sexual orientation, was surprisingly high. And there was this overall debate or awareness moment in Finland. Hey, are we, Finland, more conservative than, you know, we'd some of us would like to think? But it's, one has to be, there are many nuances there. Like you ask, for example, you ask, like, does the kind of spouse that the candidate has play a role? And if you say yes, is it a direct indicator of sort of homophobic attitude? Some said also, okay, but maybe it's because the other candidate is a foreigner in a more sort of non-European sense, and the other one is still white, European, and all that? Or is it because the other one has behaved in certain occasions in, you know, had fights or whatever? And then it's, so it's, one shouldn't jump too easily to conclusions, but yes, I believe it's clear that the sexual preference question played a bigger role than many would have guessed or hoped.
And then with this kind of information, and given that the final gap was quite, I mean, it was tiny, basically, between the candidates. Mm-hmm. Does it mean that, you know, all things equal, somehow Pekka Haavisto actually represents more of a leader that majority of Finns actually want?
Good question. It played, obviously, some role, and it lost Pekka Haavisto some votes. Then again, some might say that the fact that there was this Haavisto phenomenon, you know, 12 years ago, especially, and then 6 years ago in the previous presidential elections, had something to do with the kind of minority status that also the sexual preference dimension gives. So then it becomes complicated, like to what extent did the other candidate, Stubb in this case, benefit from the fact that Pekka Haavisto was perceived as gay, and that means something. But to what extent then, how to discount the impact of, you know, the benefit that being a minority status candidate might have given to boost Haavisto's presidential campaign, you know, already 12 years ago. So these are complicated calculations. Yeah. If one wants to measure the impact, and measuring impacts is a difficult task. Luckily, I have wonderful colleagues who are very good in doing that. So they will present results.
Looking
soon.
Forward.
You're listening to the FLT podcast.
While we are talking about identities and demographics, so our ex-president Sauli Niinistö was 75 years old, and Stubb is 55. Do you think we get next generational leader with Stubb?
I think there are some differences in style now when looking at the farewell speech by Sauli Niinistö and then first speeches and comments by Stubb after being president-elect. You could see, you know, for example, the last speech by Niinistö, he sounded a little bit like monarchic figure. It was so nice to feel the people, and, you know, there was this, you know, Finns like that. All opinion polls indicate Finns want a leader, and there's this long tradition of having an emperor in the Russian times, or king, and the strong president, and all that, and Kekkonen experience and whatnot. So Niinistö has been a strong, very successful in terms of very popular, and who was able to manage very well in terms of if the indicator is popularity, right?
Yes.
Like the Russia NATO thing and all that.
Plus so. COVID and plus COVID and the disruption from COVID and all the rest.
Yeah, but like, also before, I mean, Niinistö was very good, whether you like that morally or politically. But I'm talking in terms of good results. He was convincing people who were for NATO and people who were against NATO. People who were against NATO, like the majority of Finns until 2 years ago, they were like, oh, we have Sauli Niinistö. He's promised we will not go to NATO like that. We will have a referendum and all that. So it's good we have Niinistö there against his own or his previous party, Kokoomus. And the people who were for NATO probably knew that deep down in his heart, Niinistö is our man, and he's, you know, if shit hits the fan, he's for NATO and all that, as he was. So, so he was able to convince both sides, close to Putin, but avoiding position of being seen as Putin's poodle, able to. So, I always thought he was quite good in his tactics of being president, beside, you know, whatever I might like or not like, you know, his politics and all
so
that.
So what can we expect from Alex Alexander Stubb now in the coming years?
It's hard to see he would be as popular as Sauli Niinistö, but I think he started quite, because we live in different times and opinions are more polarized and all that. But he started quite well. He seems able, and that was actually part of his charm when he started the campaign, that he sort of recognized his past mistakes. Somewhere to me superficial and irrelevant, like do you wear shorts or do you, you know, do funny games somewhere or something, but also like things he's, you know, it came, he's very bad in math, so he made some very crucial mistakes of calculation and all that. So he was able to maybe, I think that's still a sort of sore point for him, but that was one of the things that took him down from very important positions. And he was like, when he was pointed, oh, you can't distinguish 90% from 10%. And then, you know, and then there were other things like that. And his relationship with the Russians. So he was able to sound sort of quite honestly self-critical about some of the things in his past. And I think that was part of his charm. Mm-hmm. And he was, okay, now I'm more mature, I've learned, I'm more presidential and able to recognize my past mistakes. So that was a, it's nice, more humble kind of position than the more traditional emperor or Kekkonen-like presidential style that perhaps Niinistö was still a little bit attached to.
Perhaps this is a good point because people don't know Alexander Stubb, just to do a short intro of his, sure, if you don't mind.
Yeah, go for it.
So Alex is a researcher and a politician of the National Coalition Party in Finland. In his research, Stubb has focused in the EU affairs. He was elected to the European Parliament in 2004, and 4 years later, he was appointed Minister for Foreign Affairs. In 2011, he was elected as an MP and was appointed Minister for European Affairs and Trade. 3 years later, when Prime Minister Katainen stepped down, Stubb was appointed Prime Minister. In 2016, Stubb's leadership was challenged from within his own party, and Stubb lost the party leadership to Petteri Orpo, who is our current Prime Minister, after which he resigns as Finance Minister. He does not accept any minister positions offered to him and resigns also as MP to accept the appointment at the European Investment Bank in 2017. In 2020, he was chosen as the director and professor of the School of Transnational Governance at the European University Institute. And as you said, he made mistakes. He took ownership of those mistakes. And he said, I quote Stubb, as Prime Minister, I was out of my comfort zone.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned he's not the traditional Finnish leader type, you know, in the same mold as Kekkonen or even Sauli. But there is something I think quite recognizable about his humility and I think his pragmatism. Would you classify Stubb as a very Finnish leader?
Well, he's obviously more cosmopolitan and outspoken also than some very characteristic Finnish personality. But this perception of humility that he was able to create is something that tends to go quite well in Finnish sort of political preferences and electorate. So he was able to adjust to the Finnish context and the kind of, as he may himself have said, he was more arrogant and whatnot in the old times. And we remember these phrases, like when the mic was open and he would say, like, fuck that shit, when, you know, some minister was speaking in a Nordic meeting and stuff like that. So I think he's more careful with things like that.
So Finnish politics can be fun. And entertaining.
Yeah. But as he himself said, when he said he's retiring from Finnish politics, so now presidential position is more about foreign policy and all that. So it's obvious his sort of knowledge of several languages and networks and then the combined sort of academic and political competence gives him a fairly good position to be perceived quite well in the circles where he will be moving internationally.
So what can we expect from him on the international stage, right? Finland has a very different role now in NATO and geopolitically as it's been for the past 70, 80 years. Is Stubb a good fit for that chaotic context?
Yeah, again, it's a question of, you know, political preferences and all that, but he's very capable in those terms. Some of the interesting things might be like how he will formulate his position vis-a-vis China, because that's China, I guess, is to become even more important than now for Finnish and European trade and politics more generally. So when we talk about our eastern front and eastern politics, it's not only Russia, it's China. And even though it's clear he's been very coherent in his recent expressions about Russia, and, you know, I wouldn't receive a phone call from Putin and which fits very well in the general mood in Finland, you know, the winter war moods of Finland now. But China is more complicated because there also some people have said, like, hey, are you too soft on China? Arguably, China is as much or even more an authoritarian dictatorship than Russia is. So how then to combine that with this thing of not confronting China, but perhaps de-risking, as the term in Europe now goes. And that might be more interesting and less sort of easy to predict how his China policy will develop. Because also within business community and the kind of political tendency that he, in some sense, traditionally represents, and his party and the business right-wing people are quite sort of ambiguous sometimes. On the one hand, yeah, China, it's a communist dictatorship and And then again, hey, if you want to make money in this world and have business opportunities, you shouldn't piss off the Chinese too much.
Yeah.
And how to balance that. Mm-hmm.
Do you see any weaknesses in Stubb as a leader that can actually kind of work against him during his term?
In terms of personal qualities, not really. I mean, of course, this previous, because it seems he, as he says himself, like, yeah, when I was young, I was more arrogant or something, and now he's become more statesmanlike. So in that sense, let's see, maybe not. Maybe he needs a good mathematics advisor so that certain things don't happen anymore. By the way, the government seems to need that also. They've had a couple of weird... I'm an old mathematics teacher, so it's pretty bad. What kind of mistakes they make. But in general, not. Another dimension that might be interesting is his attitude vis-a-vis sort of non-European, non-transatlantic world, not only China, but let's say Africa, Latin America, BRICS, the rise of BRICS, and all that. And I think Stubb is a little bit different from what became a current mood in the current government, actually, which was like, hey, those Southern governments, if they are not 100% with us on, let's say, Ukraine, then we shouldn't help them, or we should stop trade or at least development cooperation or something. And Sauli Niinistö was actually giving a different discourse on that, saying, hey, we shouldn't be like a teacher vis-a-vis the global South, but we should understand them something. And Alexander Stubb, since 2 years ago, has been given that kind of statements. Once I semi-jokingly, but actually very seriously, noted, like, he said something a couple of years ago, which I felt like as if somebody had just been to 101 course on like global development studies and started speaking language of, you know, post-colonial world, and we have to think about the global South as a partner and not from arrogant neocolonial view. He was doing that kind of discourse, and I thought it was different from the traditional business right-wing perspective and the kind of perspective quite prevalent within the current Council of State, current government of Finland, where that the more like downward looking discourse on global South is more prevalent. So there he might play a role also in Finnish foreign policy.
He has strong transatlantic relations, and he leans towards the US very strongly. Actually, I think during the campaign, he said at some point that he would like to visit US first, and always Finnish presidents have gone to visit Sweden first. But what's his relation with the US and Trump?
I think, and based on his pronouncements, the position is that Finland has to be able to be in good terms with any president. And I think it's quite clear that for most leaders of Finnish foreign policy elite, between Biden and Trump, the preference would be for Biden. Trump is seen as a risk, especially in terms of security policy that has become so important because the commitment to the fifth article of NATO is not so clear in Trump. So they also, they have to, but they cannot be very outspoken about that. Because they believe if they say something too critical of Trump, Trump will remember that, and that might play a role if, you know, things happen.
Right.
And so I think the attitude is a little bit like, you know, this sort of child man, Donald Trump. So let's not, even if we think he might be a risk, and I think it's obvious that's how people think, that shouldn't be said aloud because he is a risk. Part of the risk is that he might remember you say something that you don't, you'd prefer him not to be elected, which I guess is the preference of most Finnish foreign policy elite. So it's an interesting situation. It's kind of a little bit, but there might be something comparable to the, if Trump gets elected, to the, you know, old Finlandization kind of stuff. Finlandization is a complicated word because it fits a particular historical period, but something similar, like, okay, everybody knows we don't like this guy. But we can say it aloud because that might have consequences in times of, you know, war or security needs.
Okay. Well, Teivo, I have to say thank you very much for giving us your time and for giving us your perspective. I think there's been a lot to reflect on and think of. As we close up, I guess the kind of the pressing question on the other side of the election, with Alexander Stubb now in office, is what can we expect Finnish leadership to look like in the years to come?
Smiling.
A lot of smiling.
Smiling, clearly committed to NATO if things continue as they are now. Perhaps also keeping the, there's this option B always there, especially if Trump gets elected, and even with the possibility that somebody like Trump might get elected at some point, like to what extent either Europe or Northern Europe would be able to develop a community, also security community and defense capabilities that might make it not so dependent on the United States. But then again, that option is probably not going to be so outspoken, because speaking it out might then make leaders of the United States angry. So let's see. If things continue as they are, and no major escalation in the current war will happen, then there are not that many differences to be expected. One interesting thing is that in his inaugural speech as president, Alexander Stubb paid very little attention to climate crisis, where Sauli Niinistö, in his farewell speech, gave much more space to climate crisis. So, of course, since there's fairly strong, of course, scientific consensus is never total, but fairly strong scientific position that climate crisis is going to get worse. So one thing to perhaps worry about a little bit, if we have a president that doesn't consider it important enough to, for example, emphasize in his inaugural speech.
Okay, so Finnish leadership will be polite and keeping its options open.
Something like that, but of course the NATO option, the option, the mother of all Finnish options, the NATO option has already been dealt with. So yeah, but there are fewer options than before. I think the foreign policy orientation is more clear now than before.
Okay, Teivo, thank you very much for sharing your time with us and giving us your
insights. It's a pleasure, anytime. This was,
I feel far more informed about the future. I'm less worried, maybe, a little bit, I think.
I don't know. But next time we visit the breweries next to your studio here, I've heard you have good ones here.
If that brewery decides to engage us in a sponsorship deal, yes, absolutely. You know who you are. But apart from that, Teivo, thanks very much for your time. This is great.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, that was Teivo Teivainen giving us his view on the election and the now current presidency of Finland held by Alexander Stubb. How do we feel after that? Any thoughts? Anneli?
I could probably use the words of Alexander Stubb and say that I felt totally in my uncomfort zone all the time. Interesting. First of all, I want to say that I think it was really good that we cover also the new leader of Finland in our Finnish leadership podcast, because it's really important context for the whole discussion and discourse of leadership. And then Alexei's question about Pekka Haavisto's sexual orientation and Teivo's take on that was really interesting. How to study what kind of an effect it had, or did it have an effect, while both of Pekka Haavisto and Alexander Stubb have foreign spouses. So what are the different identities that play a role, and what doesn't play a role, and which plays a bigger role than another? Really interesting answer that he gave, and I think that was very insightful, and I got a lot of that.
He said it's hard to know what exact impact it had, but it definitely had an impact.
Yes.
And then he also said, which I think is the thing that I take away, is that it actually probably surprised Finns a lot to have kind of a self-realization that it did have an impact, and we probably didn't expect it to.
Yes.
Yeah. Alexei?
Well, I think Finnish politics is not that boring after all.
A lot more swearing than I remember.
Lots going on. From the leadership point of view, I think two points that kind of I picked up. So one is that we seem to be moving from more kind of Kekkonen style, which apparently even Sauli Niinistö to some extent represents, to more cosmopolitan kind of leadership approach. Mm-hmm. Of course, remains to be seen how Alexander Stubb will behave in this new role. That's one, but kind of change to more cosmopolitan leadership style. Another one is the importance of humility that we keep kind of talking with our guests here. So it seems that humility is as important in politics as it is in business leadership. So I think it was really insightful discussion that we had.
Yeah, it was. I mean, for me, I think the thing that, you know, I hadn't thought about this too much before, but actually the sort of the distance between right wing and left wing in mainstream politics here was, it's something you know and you can feel when you're in Finland. But I think the global geopolitical context kind of naturally forces you to work within a certain spectrum, and you can't get like really crazy extreme right, extreme left views. You have to sort of orient around almost a pragmatic solution. I also thought it's quite significant. I think, you know, it was a minor point in the discussion, but Stubb's plan to first meet with the American leadership rather than the Swedish leadership is actually a good statement about what's Finland's role in the world becoming. Like, because initially in the previous presidential runs, Sweden is an important partner, long-term aligned ally, but now we actually really need to understand where we stand in the global world order and how we'll be working with our neighbors on the other side of the pond. And then the other reflection that I've got is just maybe a appreciation. We kept calling it boring, and I think actually the right word we're looking for is probably civil, right? It's not necessarily boring because we still have the dynamics, but it was an election cycle that reminded me of politics 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago that wasn't sort of infected by crazy media and headline news and political attacks and
polarization.
This terrible polarization. So I think actually it's a good characteristic, maybe a function of pragmatism as well, that everything stayed civil, cordial, and we really tried to elect whatever leader we would have ended up electing would have been playing this statesman-like role. Yeah. Okay, that's us for today. Thanks to everybody that's been able to listen. I hope you found something interesting and insightful here. Thanks, as always, to Bella behind the camera and the mic. High five over there. Thanks to you, Annalie and Alexei.
And Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
You're very welcome. It was...
Anytime.
It was intense today, I have to say. Yes. I have to say. Yeah, but apart from that, thank you all for listening again, and next time.